Father, we're grateful this morning for an opportunity to look at the lives of some great men in Christian history. And we know that each and every redeemed person has a special purpose in your sovereign will. And we look forward to what you have done and looking at what you have done with those in the past and thinking about what you might be doing in our lives. And pray you give us insight into these things. In Christ's name we pray, amen. I'm going to feel lost here without my little clicker. Fell out of my bag, apparently. All right. Well, we are going to begin at this point in our modern church history. We're going to we've been looking at some of the false movements that, we look at the Great Awakening, which were good things for the most part, but then the Second Great Awakening had a mix of things coming out of it, and spent some time looking at some of the false religions and things that grew out of that, and not always the most encouraging thing, but things you need to know about. But I think we're going to go through a little phase now where I'm going to kind of step back. We moved all the way forward and almost to the 1900s. We're going to go back and just kind of pick some big names in history of Christians who were outstanding, and just take a look at their lives and some of the things that they did. And I find this to be really encouraging. The only regret I have is as I look at the lives of these individuals, there's just so much I would love to be able to pass on to you that you can only get so much in a class, but so much that goes on in the lives of these people. Just to me, I'm just fascinated by that. So I hope you are as well. I hope you'll find this an encouraging period of our study of church history. We'll be probably doing this for several weeks. I'm not going to go back and pick up every great person, as though you could know that, but just to look at some big names. Well, John Bunyan's the first one we're going to take a look at. And I have a little title. A lot of these came out of a book I have. It's a nice book. It's called 131 Christian Names That You Should Know. Funny number. And it's got all kind of Christians in there. Some people, I'm not even sure, are Christians, but, they're just famous, well-known names in Christian history. And they usually give a little title with each person and all that. John Bunyan is called the Pilgrim Who Made Progress in Prison. What do we know John Bunyan from? Pilgrim's Progress, right? So, and it's the nice thing about this book, too, is they give you a little context at the beginning of each person, so I'm going to go ahead and include their little chart. Just to place John Bunyan in his time context, he's in England, as we will see, and 1628 to 1688. So, in context, you think about the King James Bible is translated 1611. We looked at that some time ago. the Synod of Dort, where they argued over the 5 points of Calvinism versus Arminianism. Mayflower Compact was drafted in 1620. The Pilgrims came over to America because there was persecution starting to go on in England, and that's where he's located, and he endures some of that persecution. And then later on down the road, 1689, you have the Toleration Act in England, which gives some relief to people who were suffering like John Bunyan. So it puts him in England at a time when there's trouble going on for Christians. I saw a man clothed with rags, a book in his hand, and a great burden upon his back. That's a quote from the first line of Pilgrim's Progress, right? Story of Pilgrim. I'm assuming, how many of you are familiar with Pilgrim's Progress? I'm pretty sure everybody here is. So, nothing new there. Well, you may or may not know, successful English writers in John Bunyan's day were nearly synonymous with wealth. And what do we mean by that? Men like Richard Baxter and John Milton could afford to write because they didn't need to earn a living. The write takes time. And in that day, you pretty much, hand to mouth, you had to work to keep yourself alive unless you had a lot of money, which, as we're going to see, John Bunyan did not. So he's not someone we would have expected to be a writer, per se. And yet, he wrote one of the most well-known books in Christian history. Bunyan was a traveling tinker like his father. Does anybody know what a tinker is? I know what it is. I looked it up, but I just, you hear that term. I'm like, what is a tinker? He tinkers with things.
I think he fixes pots and pans.
Yes, he fixes pots and pans, basically. It's not a real lucrative trade. He wasn't getting rich. And his father was a tinker, and as was common in that day, he did what his father did. And he was nearly penniless before becoming England's most famous author. Again, a very unlikely person to become a great author, because normally great authors were people who had plenty of time to sit around and think about what they wanted to write and write great stuff. That was not his case. His wife was also destitute, bringing only two Puritan books as a dowry, as you may recall in earlier days. When a marriage took place, a wife would bring something into the marriage as a dowry, a sort of a payment to begin the marriage with. And normally it probably would have involved a certain number of things that were worth a lot. All she had was two Puritan books. This is my dowry. Here it is. But it turned out to be one of the most valuable and important dowries perhaps ever, as we'll see. So don't scoff at two Puritan books. Bunyan comments, "We came together, he and his wife, poor as poor might be, not having so much as household stuff as a dish or a spoon betwixt us both." Didn't even have a dish or a spoon. They were so poor. What allowed Bunyan to become the best-selling author of one of the most beloved books in the English language was when things got worse, an imprisonment of 12 years. So we're going to take a look at that, and why does imprisonment make it so he can write his book? But first we'll look at his conversion and early temptations. He was born in Elstow, Bedfordshire, and if you don't know where that is, I don't know if you can see that real clearly, it's just kind of in the southern, sort of central region of England. He was married at the age of 21 for his first marriage. That wife died eventually. Those books his wife brought to the marriage began a process of conversion. That's why I say those books were very valuable, because that was all she had, so he started reading them. Gradually, he gave up recreations like dancing, bell ringing, and sports, and began attending church and fought off temptations. I think it's interesting that I don't know how this plays out, but in his mind, a Christian that was inconsistent with Christianity, you know, Baptists today, many of them say you shouldn't dance, right?
Bell ringing?
Sports? Really? I didn't look deeply into that, but apparently that was a distraction of some sort in his mind, and he gave those things up as a part of his Christianity. He began attending church and fought off temptations. Bunyan wrote in his autobiography, "One morning, as I did lie in bed, I was, as at other times, most fiercely assaulted with this temptation to sell and part with Christ. The wicked suggestion still running in my mind, sell him, sell him, sell him, sell him, sell him, as fast as a man could speak." He apparently had a very tender conscience, and he struggled a lot in his early Christianity with wanting to on one hand, he was committed to Christ and totally gave his life over to Christ, and yet on the other hand, he felt a temptation to go away from that life. And so he struggled with that. He was drawn to a Christian fellowship where he saw three or four poor women sitting at a door talking about the things of God. So I imagine there were a number of churches around. This was not the Anglican church. This was an independent church, and one that would soon become illegal in England at that time. And he was attracted to it because there were three or four poor women who didn't have much money, but they knew a lot about the things of God. They were rich in spiritual things, but poor in physical things. Kind of reminds you of Jesus in Revelation, right? One of the churches he wrote to, you're poor, yet you're rich, right? He was also befriended by John Gifford, minister at a separatist church, they called it, in Bedford, which is nearby. And John Gifford kind of took John Bunyan under his wing and began to minister to him. John Gifford has his own interesting story. We can almost make him an interesting Christian to look at. I think he served in the British military at one point, and he later became converted, and he's got kind of his own story. The tinker, John Bunyan, joined the church, and within 4 years was drawing crowds from all parts as a lay minister. He had a gift of speaking, and people wanted to hear him speak. When he talks about his ability to speak and talks about, you know, people coming to hear him, here's the way he looked at his speaking. I went myself in chains to preach to them in chains and carried that fire in my own conscience that I persuaded them to beware of. So he just saw himself as a prisoner of sin, preaching to other prisoners of sins and talking about how to be free from sin. You know, I've heard other descriptions like that, you know, bringing a beggar, preaching to other beggars for bread. You know, again, he has a humility about him and about his, and he has a very strong conviction about his own sinful tendencies. And, yeah, you could look at that and say, well, he must have been a terrible guy. Or you could look at that and say, maybe we're not as sensitive as we ought to be about our own sin. That's kind of how I tend to think as I look at this. I don't think of him as being a really bad guy. But someone who was just more in tune with what maybe all of us should be more in tune with. That's one of the things that's encouraging to me in a way, and another way kind of convicting about looking at some of the people who live in other times and look at how they think about things. You know, I don't sit around in bed worrying about the stuff he worried about, you know. I guess I did when I was a young Christian, but anyhow, just interesting. Well, prison was on the horizon. And it actually ends up being a mixed blessing. His rise as a popular preacher coincided with the restoration of Charles II. Now, we did actually look at this period of English history. You may or may not remember a lot about it. But you remember that, you know, you have King James and Charles I, his son. And then the Puritans ended up coming to power. I think they ended up beheading Charles I. And for a golden era in England, the Puritans ruled, and there was freedom of religion for people to practice and become independent apart from the Anglican Church. But after a while, that petered out, and the Anglicans came back into power. And I don't know if it was as much Charles II as it was the Parliament that came into power with him that said, no more of this Puritan business. We're going back to the old ways. Anglican only, everything else is illegal. And so that's right about the time period that John Bunyan is starting to take off and preach. The freedom of worship separatists had enjoyed for 20 years, again under the Puritans, was quickly ended. Those not conforming with the Church of England would be arrested. It's that straightforward. You don't preach outside the Church of England, period. By January 1661, Bunyan sat in prison in the county prison. The worst punishment for Bunyan was being separated from his second wife. His first died in 1658, and four children. So he was married to one lady, had four children by her, and then he married a second lady. He was about 31, I think she was 17, the second wife, when he married her. And apparently he had a really close relationship with his wife and with his family, as you'd expect. He said the parting, that is being separated from his wife and his family, hath oft been to me in this place as the pulling of flesh from my bones. Here you get a picture of the poetic way he has of talking about things, right? I mean, he said, separating me from my wife is like taking flesh and pulling it off your bones. It's painful and it's unnatural, right? And that was the thing that hurt him the most about prisons, just not being able to see his wife as often as he wanted to. Although, we'll see later, some of the years of his imprisonment, he was given a certain amount of freedom to go home occasionally. He wasn't like locked in a dark cell somewhere and not able to see out or anything like that. It was a bit of a leniency, I think, eventually. He tried to support his family. Try to imagine supporting your family while you're in prison. How do you do that? Making many hundred gross, and by the way, a gross is a dozen, in case you don't know what that is, of long tagged shoelaces. Well, you're not going to get real rich making shoelaces, right? As a prisoner, that was all he could do. And he said he mainly depended on the charity of good people for their well-being. So a lot of the people in the church helped out with his family, helped to support the family. You know, back at that time, they didn't go down and sign up for unemployment checks and stuff like that. I mean, they didn't have any of those things available, as you know. And you would starve if you didn't provide some way for your family. Bunyan could have freed himself by promising not to preach, but he refused. He told local magistrates he would rather remain in prison until moss grew on his eyelids than fail to do what God commanded. Now we see a couple things here. Again, notice the poetic language, right? I'd rather remain in prison until moss grows on my eyelids. What a description. Than to fail to do what God commanded. And this is often typical in church history. Not the first time in church history this kind of thing has been presented, where the evil powers that be that are oppressing Christians say, hey, you can relieve the pressure and the problems, the imprisonment. It's easy. All you got to do is some little thing. You know, in this case, just stop preaching. Hey, that's all you got to do. No big deal. You remember back in Roman times, there was a temptation. All they had to do was offer a little pinch of incense to the emperor. And yeah, just offer a little pinch of incense and you can go back and you can go free. That's easy. But is it easy for a Christian? It's not an option. And he knows that. He realizes that. He has strong convictions. Still, the imprisonment wasn't as bad as some imagined. He was permitted, as what I was talking about earlier, he was permitted visitors. He spent some nights at home, so he did get to go home occasionally, but just not all the time. And he even traveled once to London. Surprising. The jailer allowed him occasionally to preach unlawful assemblies gathered in secret. So he even got to preach once in a while in prison. But I'm sure it was far less than anything ideal. More importantly, the imprisonment gave him the incentive and opportunity to write. So here's a bad situation, and yet because he's been, you know, he doesn't have anything else to do, he got time to write. Normally he'd be busy out working, trying to earn a living, trying to support his family. He doesn't have that chance now. He has to just sit in prison, so he can sit and write to his heart's content. And write he did. Of course, even before his arrest, he wrote three books. He wrote two against the Quakers. I thought that was interesting. We've heard about the Quakers. And he wrote another expository work. Another thing that interests me about his writing is that he writes all different kind of stuff. He's not stuck in one mode. We always think of him as Pilgrim's Progress. You know, he wrote an allegory. Well, he did, but he wrote all kind of stuff. It's interesting. He penned at least nine books between 1660 and 1672. Those were the 12 years of imprisonment, including, I just mentioned a few here, Profitable Meditations. So he wrote a book about things to meditate about. He wrote a book on Christian Behavior, A Manual on Good Relationships. So he wrote a book about interacting with other Christians. The Holy City, An Interpretation of Revelation. That's something that very few people are willing to take on, an interpretation of Revelation. It'd be interesting to read that, see how he went with Revelation. Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, considered the greatest Puritan autobiography, which means he considers himself the chief of sinners, and he wrote a story about his own life. But during the last 5 years of his imprisonment, from 1667 to 1672, Bunyan probably spent most of his time on his greatest legacy, The Pilgrim's Progress, the book we all know him for. And so we're going to look a little bit at Pilgrim's Progress and the success of it. Charles II eventually relented in 1672, issuing the Declaration of Indulgence. Bunyan was free, licensed as a congregational minister, and called to be pastor of Bedford Church. When persecution was renewed, Bunyan was again in prison for six more months. So he got out for a while. This happened a lot in England during that time. It's kind of a back and forth. You know, it gets freedom, and then, oh, nope, you're not. And then you're back in prison. So you're back in. After the second release, after a six-month imprisonment, Pilgrim's Progress was published. And then that famous line, it opens with, I saw a man clothed with rags, a book in his hand, and a great burden on his back. So begins the allegorical tale that describes Bunyan's own conversion process. The pilgrim, like Bunyan, is a tinker. He wanders from the city of destruction to the celestial city, a pilgrimage made difficult by the burden of sin, an anvil on his back, you may recall. The Slough of Despond, Vanity Fair, and other such allegorical way stations. And again, you all are familiar with the book. The book was instantly popular with every social class. So it didn't just appeal to a certain narrow band of people. Everybody liked it. In fact, it even appealed to scholars. John Owen, you may have heard of that name. He's a big-time scholar. He loved Bunyan's stuff. In fact, one time, the story is that I think it was Charles II said to John Owen, you know, why do you waste time listening to that tinker preach? And John Owen is said to have said in response, he said, I would trade all of my theological training and knowledge to be able to preach like that tinker. He just had a gift for speaking. Bunyan did. His first editor noted that 100,000 copies were already in print by 1692. This is phenomenal in that age. Samuel Taylor Coleridge called it the best Summa Theologica Evangelica ever produced by a writer not miraculously inspired. You may recall the name Summa Theologica. That's, what's his name? The Catholic guy. Aquinas. That's the name of his great magnum opus, the Summa Theologica, big giant theological treatise in Latin. And this guy's commenting, this is like the evangelical version of a giant theological treatise. Pilgrim's Progress. It's an allegory, yet it's got a lot of good theology. And if you know, those of you you're familiar with it, you know what I'm talking about. It's written in story form, but there's a lot of good theology in there, a lot. Every English household that owned the Bible also owned the famous allegory. Isn't that amazing? It eventually became the best-selling book, apart from the Bible, in publishing history. A poor tinker who normally wouldn't have been able to write at all wrote a book in prison, and it became the bestseller of all time other than the Bible. Just amazing. The book brought Bunyan great fame, and though he continued as pastor in the Bedford Church, he also regularly preached in London. He continued to write. There was another book he wrote called The Life and Death of Mr. Badman. It's been called the first English novel since it's less of an allegory than Pilgrim's Progress. Also followed with another allegory, The Holy War. Wrote a lot of stuff. Also published several doctrinal and controversial works, a book of verse and a children's book. So there was no category that he didn't seem to be able to write in. By age 59, Bunyan was one of England's most famous writers. He carried out his pastoring duties and was nicknamed Bishop Bunyan. In August of 1688, he rode through a heavy rain to reconcile a father and son, became ill, and died. And this is kind of what I call dying with your boots on, right? In other words, he died in the course of ministry. He was just going about his daily duties as a pastor. He had a situation where a father and son needed reconciled. He rode through the rain to go deal with the situation. He got sick and he died. Died with his boots on. Phenomenal man. Phenomenal man. Well, we're going to take a look at one other character today. Now, we've already looked at Jonathan Edwards, but I just felt bad because we just kind of barely took a quick look at him as a part of the First Great Awakening, you may recall. We saw a few things about him. And I didn't feel like we did him justice. And to be honest with you, even after doing this today, I'm going to still feel like I haven't done him justice. Jonathan Edwards is an amazing person. I could read about him. I could literally spend weeks teaching Jonathan Edwards. And I feel so bad not being able to. But, you know, we're limited on our time, so we have to do what we have to do. But I hope I can maybe just give you a little bit more of a taste. So again, and this is in the 131 Christians book, so we put him in context. A little bit later down the road, you see over there, there's John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress in 1678. Newton publishes his Principia Mathematica. So this is a time when the Enlightenment writers and the scientists were going at it. And that was a big influence on Edwards, so we mentioned that. And then Kant publishes his Critique of Pure Reason, a time of a lot of Enlightenment writers and scientific discovery. And Jonathan Edwards was into that as well as theology, as we're going to see. He was a man of many talents. He had a fantastic mind, just an amazingly sharp mind. This is the quote from Jonathan Edwards. And this is so classic a description of how he viewed himself. I wish to lie low before God as in the dust, that I might be nothing, and that God might be all, that I might become as a little child. I think this statement gives us a taste of the sense that he had, first of all, of God's amazing greatness. He saw God and his greatness in a way that I wish I could say I did. I mean, I want to say theoretically I do, but you know what I'm saying. He felt the greatness of God. He really felt it in his inner being. And his own humility, recognizing he just wants to lie low in front of God and be like a little child. And that was truly his attitude. At age 14, Jonathan Edwards, already a student at Yale, he was a very highly educated person, read philosopher John Locke. Now remember, we look at John Locke, he was one of the Enlightenment philosophers, was not particularly orthodox. I mean, he was one of the better Enlightenment writers who hadn't completely thrown Christianity in the trash can. He had a certain amount of, he was a deist, and he is the one who gave us the concept of governments get their power by the just consent of the governed, you know, that's in our early American documents and so forth. He was a big thinker of that day, and it says that Jonathan Edwards, as he was a student at Yale, read John Locke with more delight than the most greedy miser finds when gathering up handfuls of silver and gold from some newly discovered treasure. He just ate this stuff up, that's the way we would say it, right? Again, Locke is not a super theologian, but Jonathan Edwards was not limited to only reading those that he totally agreed with. He could find in Locke some really intellectually significant things that he just felt like he just got gobbled it up. He thought it was really worth reading. I think that's interesting. He was also a young man with profound spiritual sensitivities. You could see that from that first statement. At age 17, after a period of distress, he said, holiness was revealed to him as a ravishing divine beauty. His heart panted, and again the statement, to lie low before God in the dust, that I might be nothing, and that God might be all, that I might become as a little child. He sensed holiness to him was not just doing the right thing. To him, holiness was beautiful. It's almost like you'd look at a work of art, but even that comes short. It's just, he saw beauty in holiness. He saw beauty in who God was. And he felt that at a deep emotional level. It was not just intellectual. As smart as he was an intellectual to match any intellectual. But with that great intellect, he had deep, deep feelings. And he believed there was great significance in how we felt about things. He believed that tells who we really are. And I think he's right about that. This combination of intellect and piety characterized Edwards' whole life. That would be a good summary of Jonathan Edwards. Intellect, very smart guy, knew all kind of stuff, could read all kind of scientific and theological stuff, think through things, and yet a piety that would put most of us to shame, I think. He's sometimes referred to as the dispassionate revivalist, a kind of almost an oxymoron. So you think of a revivalist, you think about some of the revivalists we talked about, even like George Whitefield or others who were very flamboyant and passionate and flailing and as they spoke, you know. And Jonathan Edwards was said to have just kind of read things almost dispassionately. It's almost like if you just went by his tone, the way he read, there wasn't much to it. He wasn't a great orator in that sense, and yet he was very effective. Edwards was born East Windsor, Connecticut, and received his master's degree from Yale. He apprenticed for his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, for 2 years before he became, in 1729, the sole preacher in Northampton, Massachusetts Parish. In the meantime, when he was 20, he met Sarah Pierpont. Their wedding followed 4 years of often agonizing courtship for the gawky and intense Edwards, but in the end, their marriage proved deeply satisfying to both. This is another chapter of Edwards' life. It's just, gosh, we could spend a whole class on it. The relationship that he had with Sarah. She was only, when he originally started courting her, he courted her for 4 years. That's a long time for courtship, right? I mean, especially in today's I don't know if anybody at courts for 4 years today. Maybe there's going to be somebody who does. I haven't met too many. Okay. You know how old she was when he first started courting her? 13. He married her when she was 17. Okay. But they married a lot earlier back in those days. A lot earlier. So that was not as unusual as it might seem to you just hearing about it. Edwards was a real kind of awkward, gawky kind. He didn't have a lot of social graces about him. He was a great intellect, he had great piety, but he did not have a lot of social graces. Sarah, on the other hand, she was, I guess you could think of her as sort of a social butterfly. She had great cultural training. She was very genteel. She was very good at conducting herself in the higher echelons of society. And she had a lot of really desirable young men who were chasing after her. She was a beauty. She was a prize in that society. Everybody wanted her for a wife. But she was attracted to this guy who loved God because she had a really deep love for God herself. And that's what Edwards loved about her. So they saw in each other that piety and that love for God that surpassed any of the other things having to do with being awkward or not awkward, being in society, not in society. That didn't matter. And apparently they had a really, really sweet relationship. In fact, George Whitfield, you know, the great evangelist, sometimes stayed with the Edwards when he was in town preaching. He came and preached in his church. We'll see that in a minute. And George Whitfield, at the time, I guess, was single. And he said, after staying with the Edwards, he said, you know, I want to get married. He said, seeing this marriage makes me see how sweet it is to be in a good marriage. He said, I love that. So they were just a real, and that's somebody living with them, you know, and that's not just, you know, somebody writing a little article in the paper trying to make them look good. That's just somebody saying, hey, what I saw there was amazing. Edwards describes it as his relationship with his wife as an uncommon union. And in a sermon on Genesis 2, he said, when Adam rose from his deep sleep, God brought woman to him from near his heart, you know, from the rib, from near his heart. They eventually had 11 children. And apparently, from what I read, Sarah was quite good with the kids. You know, she went after them. She was a good disciplinarian. She was a good trainer. She evangelized her kids. She carried the load for Edward so that he could devote himself to his studies. Now, I think he had they said he took an hour a day that he set aside every day to play with his kids and spend time with the kids. An hour a day. That's it. He spent like 13 hours a day studying. And she wanted to free him up so he could do that. And she managed the household and managed it very well for him under his headship as a husband. In 1734, Edwards' preaching on justification by faith sparked a different sort of devotion. A spiritual revival broke out in his parish. And this, of course, would end up becoming a part of what we call the First Great Awakening. In December, there were 6 sudden conversions. By spring, there were about 30 a week. So he's just preaching a series on justification by faith, and he's having people just being converted left and right. Remember, this was a society where it was required to go to church, and most of the people in your church, or many of them at least, were unbelievers. And so while you're preaching sermons, you're preaching unbelievers, and he's evangelizing, and they're getting saved. And we note here, it's not due to theatrics. He was not some big flamboyant speaker, as we've already said. One observer wrote, he scarcely gestured or even moved. They say he just kind of read and barely even moved while he was giving a sermon. That's not what they would teach you in a sermon class today, right? If you went to study how to give a good sermon today, that's not what they teach you. And I don't know everybody has to be that. That's just who he was. He made no attempt by the elegance of his style or the beauty of his pictures to gratify the taste or fascinate the imagination. Although I would disagree with that. I think he did hit the wording that he gave very much captures the imagination. He was a very good words craftsman. Instead, he convinced with overwhelming weight of argument with such intenseness of feeling. So he had strong intellectual argument, but he also drew out the feelings of his listeners. He knew how to hit the heart of people who were listening to him. That takes a good speaker. That's not something everybody can do. That's a gift. Edwards kept a careful written account of his observations and noted them in a faithful narrative of the surprising work of God. And his most effective sermons were published in As Justification by Faith, which were widely read in America and England, so he's pretty well known. These works helped fuel the Great Awakening, a few years later, during which thousands were moved by the preaching of Britain's George Whitefield. So in a sense, some of the sermons that he was writing was laying the groundwork for Whitefield to come along and do his preaching. There was a combination of things that God was using at this time to create what we call the Great Awakening. It's not something that any one person pulled off. Whitefield had read Edwards' books and made it a point to visit him when he came to America, and that's where he had that experience looking at his family life. And Edwards invited Whitefield to preach at his church and reported the congregation was extraordinarily melted, almost the whole assembly being in tears for a great part of the time. The whole assembly, including Edwards himself. So Whitefield was a very moving speaker as well. He had the ability to speak in a way that tears were rolling down the cheeks of people who were out in the audience listening. You don't see that today. You don't, for whatever reason. During the Great Awakening, Edwards contributed perhaps the most famous sermon in American history, Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God. I think we mentioned this before. We actually read this in high school, although the teacher, condemned it as typical of a Puritan mindset, blah, blah, blah. But it's actually a very good work, and it basically reminds people that we are hanging by a thread over hell. And it wakes you up to the reality of that fact. You could die any minute. I just heard a story the other day about a girl walking down the street, what was it, in San Francisco with her date, and some guy jumped out of a window up above the two of them to commit suicide, and he fell on the girl and killed both of them instantly. She just died like that. And what Edwards does in the sermon is he points out, you are this close to dying. You don't know how long you'll live. And you will be in the hands of an angry God who despises your sin. And he made you feel your need for salvation. Now, today, that's not popular. Now, don't talk about hell. Don't talk about sin. No. But he did, and he was very effective with it. Unfortunately, it has since cast Edwards as an emotional and judgmental revivalist, when in fact he preached it dispassionately as any of his sermons. He still read it in that sort of voice that he read it in. Despite his dispassionate style, Edwards insisted that true religion is rooted in affections, not in reason. That's one thing that's unique about Edwards, and I do appreciate this about him. You can intellectually espouse all kinds of things. I believe this, I hold to that, but where's your heart? Where does your heart really run? Where are your affections, he would say. And he said, that tells you more about yourself than what you tell me you believe. Worth thinking about, isn't it? He defended the emotional outburst at a Great Awakening, especially in his treatise on religious affection. That's a book I've read. A masterpiece of psychological and spiritual discernment. And he wrote another book, Some Thoughts Concerning the Present Revival of Religion in New England, in which he included an account of his wife's spiritual awakening. In a day when psalm singing was almost the only music to be heard in congregational churches, Edwards encouraged the singing of new Christian hymns, notably those of Isaac Watts. There was a time, and this is that era, and to this day, in fact, I visited, Jason went to a college one year up in Canada and attended a Presbyterian church up there. And they were like this. They only sang out of a psalter. They did not have a hymn book like we have. They sang songs out of a psalter. And that was pretty common at this era and this place. But Edwards was a little on the, you might say, leading edge in that regard. And he said, I think we can sing things that people have written. Like Isaac Watts wrote some good stuff. Let's sing those songs. Of course, we all sing still to this day Isaac Watts songs, right? He was also influenced by Newton. That would be Isaac Newton. Edwards regarded personal conversion as critical, so he insisted only persons who made a profession of faith, which included a description of their conversion experience, could receive communion. He was serious about people making a genuine confession of faith before he would let them receive communion. That reversed the policy of his grandfather. We've talked about this. This is the one thing we did talk about with Edwards. And so they booted him out in 1750, and he became a missionary to the North American Indians in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And he wrote some other theological treatises. In it, he argued, we are free to do whatever we want, but we will never do God's will without a vision of his divine nature imparted by the Spirit. So he said, we have a will, we can do whatever we want, but unless God changes our will to do God's bidding, it's for naught. But here's where he's fascinated by science. Fascinated by Newtonian physics, enlightened by scripture, Edwards believed that God's providence was literally the binding force of atoms, that the universe would collapse and disappear unless God sustained its existence from one moment to the next. And he would use a passage like Hebrews 1:3, that Christ is upholding all things by the power of his word. So he loved science, but he saw a connection between science and theology. It's Christ that holds all things together. Yes, the things Newton's discovering, they're true. Such were the fruits of his lifelong habit of rising at 4 a.m. and studying 13 hours a day. The College of New Jersey, later called Princeton, called him as president in 1758, but soon after his arrival, Edwards died of a new smallpox vaccination. He was 55. He was a big believer in science, even the newly developing science of vaccinations at that time. Unfortunately, this was the vaccination that went wrong, and he died from it. He left no small legacy. Edwards is considered, some would say, with Reinhold Niebuhr, America's greatest theologian. So, really a lot to see there. Wish I had even more time to devote to him, but at least that gives you a little better picture. Next week, we'll kick off with John Newton, who you know is the author of Amazing Grace and also the notorious, in his early years, slave trader. Very interesting character there, so we look forward to looking at that. All right, discussion question. Why do you think that people who are otherwise rational and sensible people fall? Oh boy, that's the wrong list of questions. Hang on, how did I get there? Please tell me that I didn't put the questions in some place where I can't find it now. That's not good, folks.
Do you want me to read them?
Yeah, you've got them, right? Well, so I know I had them, but you go ahead and read them while I'm going to try and find it on here.
John Bunyan was in prison for 12 years and yet could have gotten free at any time if he had only been willing to agree to stop preaching. Do you think we may someday face such a choice as Christians? If so, do you think you will have the kind of convictions John Bunyan did? What on the surface seemed to be John Bunyan's greatest curse, imprisonment, proved to be a great blessing. Can you think of a time in your life when God used a bad situation to bring about a great blessing? Next question. Jonathan Edwards, sometimes referred to as America's greatest theologian, in addition to his deep understanding and interest in theology, also had a deep and passionate interest in science and in the works of the not-so-orthodox philosophers of his day. How do you suppose he was able to be so strongly committed to sound theology and yet still enjoy the philosophers of his day? Next. When Bunyan married his second wife, he was 31 and she was 17. Edwards began courting Sarah when she was 13 and married her when she was 17. Marriage at such an early age was not uncommon in those days. Why do you suppose couples in our culture tend to marry so much later in life? Is that a good thing?
So kind of a wide range of things for us to think about there. But.
I do see a trend on that last question. There is a trend in what some have referred to as a delayed adolescence. The living in your parents' basement syndrome, not getting a job, video games all day, not growing up and taking on responsibility. And there's been alarms raised in terms of the concern there. And it translates into delayed marriage, with delayed marriage, delayed childbearing. So the nuclear family is being exchanged for just being single. And that being not, I mean, some, wouldn't choose that, due to circumstance, that is how it is. Others are intentionally putting off marriage and would rather be single. And it's a cultural phenomenon of our day. Turn back the clock, it was very much prioritized to put down roots and to put down roots as early as possible. That being a part of God's plan, it is not good for man to be alone. Type thinking. So see that a trend continuing into today's cultural set. I don't know all the whys and wherefores of it.
Yeah, I don't either. That's why I asked the question, because it's curious to me. And this is not, I mean, this was not new to me. I mean, even back in, I think they speculate about how old Mary was when she had Jesus. You know, throughout history, women have typically married at a much younger age. Sometimes it's explained as, well, the life expectancy was so short you had to get with it quicker, maybe. But then again, a lot of times life expectancy was an average, and so many people died in childbirth. People still lived to be, you know, 70 or 80 quite often back in the day. I mean, maybe not as often as today. We don't have the medical care we have today. So, you know, maybe that's part of it. Maybe there's a more seriousness about life.
That doesn't really hold water. I know people would say that, but the life expectancy having anything to do with it. If you can remember yourself as a teenager, there is no life expectancy. You're going to live forever. You're not dwelling on issues of mortality. It's just not part of the psyche of an adolescent.
Yeah, sure.
So that's I know people have pointed to that, but I think it's pretty well garbage. There are a number of things like our culture, and one of the significant changes is that Western culture is not fundamentally based on any religion anymore. So even if you go to Eastern cultures, where early marriage is still practiced or arranged marriage is still practiced, their culture is still essentially based on some form of religion, not necessarily Christian. I can't think of any significant people groups that have Christian, but Muslim and even Hindu and some of the others. And when we got away from that as a culture, there is now no association of fornication and loose living with being inappropriate. That's no longer taught. That's no longer held as a core value of our society. So there's no need to get married.
Like, yeah, marriage is obsolete.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew people, you know, employees that he was with his girlfriend. They lived together for 10 years before they got married, and it was to them, why? There's really no need to get married.
Yeah, that's pretty common. That's pretty common today.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it is.
And a lot of issues surrounding marriage and childbirth are now dictated by economic status, not by.
That's interesting.
Not
yeah.
by any kind of.
I hear that a lot. That I'm not ready to be married. I need to X, Y, and Z before I can be married. And like, there's this threshold that you've got to get to. And at the same time, if I'm counseling somebody about their readiness to be married, I'm going to talk to them about. Physical readiness? Are you sexually, physically mature for that? And I guess that's where an age range would be. The maturity level, are you ready, if you're talking to a man, are you ready to start providing for a family? A spiritual readiness on the equally yoked spectrum there. So it seems that in earlier years, one would reach maturity in those different categories at a much earlier age than they're reaching them now.
Part of that, I would say, I attribute to the No Child Left Behind philosophy, is actually instead left all children behind. if they come up in the public education sector, which teaches them, they don't need to grow up.
Yeah.
They don't need to, and we have set these standards, at least in America. I don't know about other Western European nations, but for instance, that we tie so much to the age of 18. Mm-hmm. Why?
Yeah.
It's fairly frivolous if you think about it, and maturity, males and females tend to not mature at the same rate. Usually females mature faster. They're more mature at an earlier age, which explains why historically, a lot of times, other than the physical reasons, you have older males and younger females. A 13-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl are not the same place.
Well, just and when I talk about physical sexual maturity, the whole concept of puberty and the age range that happens at, bec- because of our cultural setting, I see the, I'm uncomfortable thinking about a teenager getting married. But why do I think that way?
Right.
That's probably a cultural deal when, if we think about how God has designed even the body of preparation and maturity. So one, I think, needs to think about those different layers.
That kind of, to me, leads and connects with the idea of science and religion, for lack of a better term, cohabitating. If we believe, I mean, it would be hard for me to not say that you have to agree that there is some factual truth in science. Not all of it. So in light of what we were just talking about, if God designed us so that a certain age, puberty hit, hormones kicked in, and the desire to do grown-up things goes into overdrive, he has made the body ready to reproduce. But we say, no, 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 you're too young, you shouldn't do that. Why?
Well, and today,
because we know better than God when the body is ready or when a person is ready.
But today you can see why they say it. I understand your point, but you know, I can't even imagine seriously courting a 13-year-old girl, and yet
that's
most 13-year-old girls
are historically a thing.
I know.
That's why parents picked them out. The kids were too young to know, but hey, it's time for you to start being a man now. I mean, when you look at bar mitzvahs in Jewish history, it's 13 years old.
Right.
When a boy hits puberty, it's like, okay, it's time for you to move from boyhood into manhood and start dealing with some adult responsibilities.
So a very Western delayed putting off of those things.
And maybe, go ahead.
I keep waiting for somebody to say to me this so obvious is that we don't train our children for adulthood. We train them for having a wonderful childhood and having wonderful memories and thinking
that's a great point.
And being independent and everybody, what career do you want? How much
and
money do you want to do?
That's
and
very
be a
recent,
big
very
yeah.
Recent
so
I mean,
the whole thing is very selfishly motivated, and it's not. I'm training you to be a good wife and mother. I'm training you to be a responsible father and husband. It just doesn't happen.
Well, then that could be a big part of the answer to the question, why is it a cultural phenomenon?
Because it's almost, you know, and maybe it is tied into the school system like you meant, because we sort of create this sort of teenage bubble, you know, in our culture, where you're just in this kind of weird stage where you're not old enough to be an adult, and so you're just in there being a crazy, you know.
The other thing is with the advancement of technology, and especially in our country, wealth. I mean, our poorest American is wealthier, still in the top, 3-4% of the wealthiest in the world.
Oh, yeah.
So there is no pressure on us. We don't think about, he's not sitting back there thinking, how am I going to survive? How am I going to have food to eat? It's not even a question. It's not even a thing. There's no pressure behind that.
Yeah.
But if we have no wars, really, not in our soil. So even going back to the beginning, the early part of, to the mid of the 1900s, there were kids who were going to war at a young age, before they were 18. I mean, Pop, my grandfather, was one of those that lied about his age and went to World War II when he was, I don't know, 15, 16 years old. You know, and coming out of the Great Depression where people were starving, you had, every kid was necessary to provide food for the family. So we don't have those pressures. So in a sense, wealth is a curse to our nation, to our development as people.
Yeah. Oh man, I wish we could go on with it. We're actually 5 minutes over, even, but we've only dealt with one of the questions, so I must have thought up some good questions today.
But we have to say one more thing.
Okay.
We got to talk about Edwards and what's his name here for a second.
Bunyan.
Sarah.
Bunyan.
Oh, Bunyan. Okay.
Got to say something about both those guys. First of all, we read in our little thing there about Edwards because of his sermon. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, that he's gotten this reputation as being, you know, this angry or fiery or whatever thing.
Judgmental,
yeah. But one of the best sermons I've ever heard was a guy by the name of Sam Storms. Mm. And he says that if you read Edwards and understand his knowledge of wrath and hell, you also have got to read him, because nobody has a concept of heaven like Jonathan Edwards.
Mm.
So I would recommend to you Sam Storm's sermon on Jonathan Edwards and his idea of heaven, and you can find that easy enough on sermon audio or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing would be Spurgeon said of John Bunyan, one of the most important writers ever, Spurgeon would read 6 books a week, and once a year, one of those books would be
The Pilgrim's Progress.
He read it once a year, every year, and his comment on Bunyan was, he didn't have blood, he had bibline. If you poked him, he wouldn't bleed. He would just, he would spurt Bible. So, two excellent guys that we're looking at today.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to get some of my stuff back out and refresh myself.
Yeah, I mean,
it's good stuff.
The overwhelming feeling I have teaching today, and probably will through this whole series, is I feel like I'm doing such an inadequate job of getting across to you what these guys were like. We just have no idea. You know, some of the things you're bringing out.
Yeah.
I wish I could spend time, but it is what it is. All right. Father, thank you for this time, and thank you for the discussion, and thank you for those of you who have raised up in times past. Raise up men like this in our day. Make us these kind of people. Help us to become more serious about our faith, about our love for you, and to learn from these things. Christ, then we pray, amen. You're dismissed.